Hello, Ted. I see you have a Star Wars shirt on. It's episode 121.
121.
It's Friday night, and we are too. All right. How are you?
I am tired. It's been a long week.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Kind of a strange week.
I agree with that.
And yes, from there, I don't know. I'm interested to hear how your week is going. We did some things this week, but let's jump into your week. I'll let you drive a little bit more tonight.
Okay. Well, I have Clarissa sitting on the sidelines here waiting for like a glass of beer. So okay, I'm going to crack my beer first. And I have a Russian river. How do you know?
I can see the cap right at the edge of the screen.
Oh, there you go. I have a Russian River Happy Hops IPA, 6.5 ABV. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of a cool bottle, you know? And so we'll see. I got this at Valley Brewers, where I tend to get, you know, in the back room there from Sandy. And I know I talk about their beers once in a while, and like a lot of these beers I can only get there. I wish there was another place in town a little bit closer to get some of these exotic beers. But, you know, hey, whatever. I get some great beer there. Yeah, they're a little proud of them, but that's okay. I mean, you don't get beers if they're not proud, right?
Yeah.
What beer do you have while I'm pouring, and then we'll get into the week after that.
So I have a Smog City Brewing Company.
Smog City. That sounds like it's from California.
It is Californian. It's right around here.
It sounds like LA.
It's from Torrance, so it is LA. So Smog City, it's called Amarillo Gorilla.
Amarillo. Oh, Amarillo hops probably.
Amarillo Gorilla. Forceful notes of mango, papaya, and a touch of citrus and pine in the nose are balanced by a light malt profile and restrained bitterness to keep the beast drinkable.
So here's an interesting thing, though. So what it says on this bottle, I mean, I hate reading bottles and cans. I mean, but this is interesting, I thought. Happy Hops was originally brewed in 1944. Like, that's the war years. By the Grace Brothers Brewery in Santa Rosa, California. We are paying homage to the Grace family, whose brewery closed in the 1960s, and have revived Happy, the charming hop character who graces the front of this label. What I find interesting is, and the reason I wanted to read that, is when you think about American brewing, and you think about American beer, up until, I don't know, the mid-2005s, whatever, the mid-aughts. Mm-hmm. Everything before that you think is like a Budweiser or like we call Yellow Fizz.
Right.
But I mean, in the 40s, they were doing these crazy hoppy beers. I mean, where did we go wrong for 60 years after that? I mean, and that's the reason, like, I don't typically read my bottles and cans, but I think like when you consider
the history
of beer in America and how horrible it was for like a century, you're telling me this beer was made in 1944? Like, okay, where did we go wrong? How do we lose these beers? And with that said, this is like a really amazing beer. It's up your alley. It's more citrusy than piney, but it is a West Coast IPA.
Right.
I mean, it's really nose forward on the hops, but I mean, super smooth, and it's as if you peeled an orange and bit into a pine cone. That's the best way to describe it. It's amazing. But to think that this recipe is from 1944, like I find that hard to believe.
That's awesome.
How's your beer? What do you have?
My beer is very similar. It has the pine notes and the citrus notes. Again, very, very well balanced. I noticed on the sticker, you know, it's another that silver can with the sticker on it. But the sticker has a gorilla on it, but it has these two planes that are dropping hops out of them. So it's like hop bomb is for sure. So it is an amazing 7.4 ABV.
Yeah, you got me by 0.9.
I won the week.
Yeah, okay, so you wanted me to go first on the week and everything, and
yeah, let's see where it goes.
So school ended yesterday. I know, okay. Your kids have been out for about a week.
Mm-hmm.
But school ended yesterday. Mixed emotions. I mean the teachers put out their videos that they put together, and they did these little like slideshows, and everybody's like teary-eyed, and it's like, oh, the school year ended abruptly and we didn't get to finish properly. And
it's hard for them, I think, you know. It's,
yeah, well, it's hard for them, it's hard for me, you know. I mean, it's hard for mom, it's hard for like all the parents and stuff. I mean, especially when your kids are kindergarten, first grade and everything. It's one of those things where it's like, wow, their first year just like ended in a train wreck. And but the point I want to say, though, is no fault of anybody. I mean, it just happened.
Right.
And no 5-year-old needs to have an education through the computer. I think that's awful.
Right.
But with that said, though, I want to say that my kids' teachers and teachers' aides and teachers, like, they have their like reading assistants or what, I'm not really sure what they are, but like people who come in and they do these like tutoring reading groups and stuff, and they do all this work with them and everything, and these people have taught for years, and they don't teach you how to, well, teach over the internet in college or anything. They teach you more the traditional methods, like kids are in the classroom and here's what we're going to do and everything. And their teachers put together curriculum, and they did all of this awesome work. They scraped together, they pulled themselves up, and they put together a curriculum that worked. They did what they needed to do with the resources they had. And man, these teachers that my kids have, you know, I mean, they were so amazing. And I can't commend them with accolades higher than I could possibly commend them for what we have.
Right.
You know, I mean, we were all given the shaft this year, teachers, students, parents alike. And I mean, everybody pulled through, and they really pulled it together, and their teachers just came through with amazement. And I'm sure a lot of teachers and every kid's teachers out there, you know, they all did that stuff, you know, but
yeah.
But to see the end of the year and the little videos and all this stuff and the heartwarming, man, I'm without words,
yes,
to describe my gratitude for how they pulled this all together. And then we're sitting here as a family watching these videos and stuff, and like, there's not a dry eye in the house.
Oh, it's great.
You know, it was fantastic. It was fantastic. So, yeah, school's over. You know, on the other side, I'm happy it's over. I mean, it was tiresome. I think on all parts, too, teachers, kids, parents, I think it was tiresome. And I'm glad we're into summer, and hopefully, and maybe I should say, I'm more hopeful that August will bring back a regular school year, because I think kids, especially young ones, need to learn in the classroom with other kids in that social environment and hands-on arts and crafts and all the stuff that they do.
Right.
We had the latest in bike advocacy. We had the revisit of the city council this week, and they approved everything that we were pulling for and everything that I wrote about and stuff. All of it, 100%.
That's awesome.
They added it all in, and after they removed it all, now they added it all. So, I mean, that was incredible. It's great to see that they got everything back in the plan. Now it's like, I don't know, what, 5, 8, 10 years to get it built, maybe longer. I hope not.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. It got put in.
It's in the plans.
It's in the plans, yeah. And then, you know, here in Lompoc, we had some protests. We had, you know, some marches and things with all the George Floyd stuff and, you know, all of the, I mean, I don't even, I don't even know how to talk about it. It's just...
Right.
It is what it is. I mean, but we had that here in town, and fortunately, everybody here in Lompoc was peaceful. It was quiet.
Uh-huh.
They made the points that I think they needed to make.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, without violence and without anything that disrupted our community. And I think the people of our town recognize that. The one thing I think that's really disappointing, I think, is people who hijack these things.
Right.
You know, you might have black, brown people. I mean, we're like 1.5 white guys here. I'll leave that to the audience to decide. We're not the demographic who the police target and so on, right?
Right. We will never, I think that's the thing, right? That's the idea is that we will never know. You know, I don't know if you've had run-ins with the police as a young person, you know what I mean? Years ago, like 20 plus 30 years ago.
I have. I was racially profiled once.
Well, every time I've had a run-in, you know, you think back to them and you think of how different it could have been, you know, if you were African-American or, you know, darker skinned or whatever. But yeah, so being an ally is the only thing we can do. And I think understanding that we will never know what that feels like is part of the way there to what we need as a American community now.
I wanted to finish up my thought, and then yeah. I want to talk about how I was racially profiled.
Okay, cool.
But I was racially profiled in a double, racial profiling way or something, you know, a double racist way. But before I get to that, what I want to talk about is how in a lot of the cities and everything, you have this like Antifa movement,
uh-huh.
right? And it's, I think what's happening is you have black and brown people who come out in solidarity and they want to have their protest silent or whatever. And I think what happens is you get this... I think it's like a socialist anti, like a super left-leaning radical movement, but it's like white kids from the suburbs who are too busy taking sociology classes, you know? So they come in to the inner city and disrupt things in a violent way. Or it's like you have neo-Nazi type movements who come in and start doing these things. And it's almost like they hijack the movement that's going on or the message that's being sent. And then there's like, you know, my mom type person sitting at home in suburban America,
uh-huh.
who then watches this on Fox News and says, oh, man, you know, like this is terrible. They need to like, you know, shoot to kill. That's what Mayor Daley said.
Oh, my God.
And all this stuff, right? And it's like, but the people who are throwing Molotov cocktails and everything, like, well, like I say, I mean, every Molotov cocktail is 10,000 votes for Trump, you know?
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, like, I think what happens is you get these either radical left-leaning, or radical right-leaning people coming in and hijacking this movement, this opportunity. And what happens is they hijack it in such a way that it takes the message and forms it into something other than what the message is to be. And then because they're wearing masks and things, and I don't mean COVID-19 masks. I mean like,
right.
You know, they're wearing like
full on face covering. Yeah.
Yeah. Balaclavas or something. And then it comes out to be that the unlearned person at home is like, look at all these anarchists. That's it. Like they're all the same.
Right.
The George Floyd, give us an equal voice protester in a sense, and the radical neo-Nazi throwing the Molotov cocktail, hijacking the moment person, they get all lumped into the same because they're all in the same crowd, even though people are there for different messages.
Yeah, so there's definitely the media movement and then the movement, you know? So it's all on what sells newspapers, what gets clicks, you know, it's clickbait.
Well, that, yeah.
If a fire happens during a protest, that's probably more clickbaity than, you know, the peaceful protest my son and daughter and myself went to this Thursday, you know? We went to Burbank. Audrey wanted to go to a protest. She'd been saying it all week. You know, Monday and Tuesday of this week, I was just like, no. You know, I had heard about the, you know, LA, and I said, you find the protest, you find the march, you find the peaceful gathering, and I will say yay or nay on whether we can go and do it or not, you know? So she found one in Burbank on Thursday.
Like, how do you find it, though? I mean, where do you...
It's on social media. It's on, like, you know, she's...
Oh, okay.
She's...
Okay.
She's in the movement. She's been in the movement since before George Floyd. She's been, like, you know, a little obsessive about... the equality movement. And I thought, that's okay. That's healthy. That's part of growing up. You know, you find a cause, you latch onto it. And when George Floyd was murdered in the streets on multiple cameras, it was so in our face that, you know, she just felt like she would cry every night. Every night that I, you know, would say that we can't go to a protest. So she found this one and, you know, we talked about it a little bit. And then I was like, but, you know, the protest in and of itself, it's only the beginning. It's only the start of what you, if you want to do something, going out and marching about it is kind of like voting. You know what I mean? Voting is a step towards something, right? It's a step towards something, but it's not the whole thing. It is an indication that you are willing to do this one step. And then beyond that, you have to do other things. You have to continue the pressure. You have to continue being vocal. You have to continue giving voice to other people who don't necessarily have the voice or don't have the funds or the scope and the reach of whatever it is that you have. So she came up this week with some of my, you know, marketing angles that I was looking at. She's going to start a nonprofit. And we're looking into how to, you know, make a 501c3.
Oh, wow.
And this is kind of good. This is going to be her summer project. And I said, you know, it's going to look great on your college entrance exams. And she goes, that's not why I'm doing this, Dad. That's not why I'm doing this. And I'm like, fine. I'll help. I'll still help you. It's called $16.19.
Crazy smart kids.
And so $16.19, I was running with her one day this week and I said $16.19.
That's the name of the nonprofit?
That's the name of our nonprofit, $16.19.
Okay, what's the meaning behind the name?
So 1619 was the year that slavery in America started. So 401 years ago, slavery started in America, and slavery is the basis of our wealth of the country, you know? And a lot of people talk about reparations and it's hard. It's a really hard thing to talk about because there's no way to value the cost of the labor that the slaves put into this country, but they were never compensated for it. So there is some thought that we should pay reparations. And as an ally to those people, and my daughter's not an ally, she kind of identifies as a person of color, and that's her right. You know, she's half Indian and a quarter Filipino and a quarter Caucasian. So, you know, she's allowed to identify as a person of color.
Yeah.
I think, you know, and so that's what she said. And I said to her, I said, this is great. What we'll do is we'll make all the contributions to this, to our nonprofit, in the amount of $16.19. Or for the rich people, they could be $1,619. You know, we'll do two tiers. And I said, it'll be this $16.19. And it's kind of like a reminder every time it comes out of,
I'll round it up to $20.
Every time it comes out of your, every time it's a donation made, you know, it comes in the amount of this reminder that slavery was the basis of a lot of wealth in America. You know, the podcast I was talking about last week, Snacks Daily, this week they had all their snack facts. They do a snack fact, which is like a financial historical fact. They had all of them based in African-American history in America. And, you know, they had great facts about the cotton industry and how it was, you know, how rich it made people, but it didn't make any slave rich, you know, the people that were actually picking the cotton.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of pain for 401 years is kind of something you can't just, you know, march on Washington about. You can't let it end with where it begins, a march or a vote. It has to just start there and continue. So I said, so what are we going to do with your nonprofit? What is it going to do? And I think what we decided together was that we'll identify other nonprofits and kind of help funnel money from, you know, from us raising it, with raising awareness of this year and what it means, and then funnel it to those other nonprofits. You know, we met someone at the protest that's talking about Gen Z. They have a Gen Z project, and she's like trying to get Gen Z people interested in arts and doing things to uplift their generation. So we're going to work with them, and we're going to work hopefully with the NAACP. And I just, you know, started rattling off a bunch of people for Audrey to reach out to on social media. Because obviously, if you're a 14-year-old and you're trying to do this, then you probably would get further than a 45-year-old half white guy.
You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. And I think the one thing where people miss out on when you think about like reparations and things, and I hear this a lot of times in the circles that I run with and stuff, you know, namely my family and so on. But when it's talked about, it's like, oh, well, you know, I never owned slaves,
right?
You know, and you always hear like the same arguments, mm-hmm. right? And it's not about whether or not that somebody who was born in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s ever owned slaves. And it's not about whether the people of those same years were ever slaves.
Right.
Because obviously that's not the case. And I think it's a false equivalence.
Right.
What I think what you're looking at, though, is generational wealth.
Yes.
And over the years, like when I look at my family going back, you know, I mean, 130 years or something here in the United States, maybe longer.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at great grandparents to grandparents and, you know, parent and so on. And you look at the jobs everybody held and you look at the bank accounts that they were able to fund,
right?
Based on being like, my grandfather was an aerospace engineer and other grandparents owned houses and they were able to share some of that money with their grandkids. And over time, we've kind of been able to build up a little bit of a familial
pot. Yeah.
Yeah. Pot of wealth.
Right.
That we've all benefited from. But when you look at somebody who may have been a descendant from a slave from 1700s, 1800s and, you know, moving forward, and then Jim Crow and all that kind of stuff, I mean, they never had the opportunity to buy houses.
Right.
They never had the opportunity to have the jobs. I mean, whether it was redlining, whether it was just institutional racism that the government, I mean, more or less outlined, or it was, you know, the de facto, the de jure, however the racism was, they never had the opportunity to gain any foothold. So with that, yeah, I mean, there is reparation that ought to be paid to some people, because now here they are all these many generations later and they still have nothing, where myself, I benefited generation after generation and I'm in a great spot today because of all that.
Yeah.
I have no problem with reparation types ideas or plans or however that plays out. But man, so many people do, because it's like, you know, I think the big thing is it's like when you hear, I mean, how many people celebrate Christmas, right? I mean, like 98% of the country celebrates Christmas. All of a sudden, it's like one person says, oh, well, you know, I'm Jewish, I don't celebrate Christmas, or whatever it might be, right?
Right.
And all of a sudden, it's like, oh my God, there's a war on Christmas. There's no war on Christmas. There are people who do things different than what the majority do. And the minority, it's not that they're asking you to abandon what you're doing. They're not even asking you to compromise. They're just asking you to acknowledge. And that acknowledgement isn't a war on what your beliefs are. It's just saying not everyone has the beliefs you have.
Right.
Anyway, so I made mention to how I was racially profiled.
Yes.
And I wanted to touch on that and talk about how it was a double racial profiling.
Okay.
So I was working in, this is like, oh man, this is like 94 or 95, somewhere in that range.
Okay.
And I worked as a commercial industrial painter, and I was working in Pittsburgh at the time. And in Pittsburgh, they have this neighborhood called the Hill District. And I come to find from this interaction that the Hill District is drugs, prostitution. You know, it's a black neighborhood. It's a bad neighborhood, as they would call it. You know, it's just, it's like what you would consider the ghetto and everything, like you'd see on The Wire or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was pouring rain this one day, and we were painting Kmart's in the area, the outside. So it was raining. We couldn't paint. So we're like, well, let's go downtown. We'll see what's going on. And, you know, we'll go check out some stuff. And, you know, we're going past where like the Penguins play, and we wind up like taking a wrong turn, and we wind up in this neighborhood, the Hill District. And we were in, it was a late model GMC Jimmy. It was black, had nice wheels, tinted windows. I mean, the thing was kind of decked out a little bit, you know, for what it was. And we take a wrong turn. We wind up in this neighborhood. And I'm like, oh, man, wrong turn. You know, I'm in the passenger seat. Oh, wrong turn, you know. So we wind up going down an alley. We wind up turning left, turning right. We're trying to figure out how to get the heck out of this neighborhood. And we see this car following us. And it was like this beat up Pontiac Bonneville or something. It was like a piece of, it was like a hoopty. Anyway, so we finally get out of the neighborhood. Sure enough, they put a gumball on the roof and pull us over.
Really?
They get out, guns drawn, and we're like, they're after us. I'm in the passenger seat. My friend John was driving, and then this kid Tom, who was our apprentice, he was another white kid, he was in the back seat.
Right.
So they come walking up and guns drawn, and they're like, you know, hands where you could see him, get out and everything. And they have us on the car, they frisk us, and you know, hands in our pockets, looking for drugs, looking for, you know, like wads of cash or whatever it was. So they said, you know why we pulled you over? Because we weren't speeding. I mean, we were definitely going slow, trying to find our way out of there.
Right, right.
So, no, we don't know why you pulled us over. So the police, they're undercover and stuff, plain clothes in this, like, hoopty Bonneville. And they pull us over, and they said, out-of-state plates, because we're from Illinois at the time.
Uh-huh.
Out-of-state plates, late model vehicle, white guys in a known drug prostitution neighborhood.
Right.
So, you know, why else are white guys in this neighborhood? They're looking for drugs.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I'm thinking like, wow, it was racially profiled. But the reason why I say it was a double racial profile is like, how horrible is it that, you know, well, what if the Hill District was a white neighborhood? They wouldn't say like, oh, black man's there because white people are drug addicts. And, you know, if you reverse everything, right?
Right.
What they would do there is they'd say black man, they're trying to steal from white people. That would be the reverse side of it.
Right.
But in this case, it's like, oh, white guys going in black neighborhood. Why? Because black people are into drugs and prostitution.
Right.
You know, it's like, I mean, the whole thing is just clouded in these like stereotyped overtones.
Right.
I mean, it's just horrible. You know. Anyway, so being a white guy in a black neighborhood getting pulled over for the only reason white guys are in black neighborhoods is to get drugs or like, I don't know, hookers. And then to say like, well, why are white guys there? Oh, because black neighborhoods only have like drugs right. and hookers.
There's no other reason that
there's no other reason why I would be there. What if I was there to see my buddies?
Right.
You know, like that can't happen.
Yeah.
I know. It's like, I don't know how we get around all of this, but I know I've kind of like stolen the stage at this point, but let me finish up with one of the shows we've been watching because
okay, cool.
it really bothered me. And that's the Black AF show that you turned
right.
me on to. And last night I texted you, what was that show again? I wanted to watch it, you know? So you text me back like hashtag Black AF. Okay, so we put it on. And that show kind of bothered me a little bit. And maybe I wouldn't have been as sensitive unless it was this, you know, the situation and the kind of the, you know, the era that where we are, right?
right?
And, you know, a lot of it too, though, is like he's talking to, you know, like some white guy, whatever. And they're having this little
his
interaction,
assistant, right?
And then after the white guy, no, it was the other guy. I don't remember.
He was to Levitan, the creator of Wings and all of the great TV shows of the past. Yeah.
Yes,
and the creator
exactly.
of Modern Family. Yes,
and he gets in his car and he's like, "I hate white people." Okay, sure, whatever. That's funny. And it goes on and everything. And then the Jewish assistant.
Right.
And it's like he's like berating this guy and making him look like a buffoon and everything. And he would consistently say how much he hates white people uh-huh. and all this stuff and making white people look dumb and everything. And I'm watching this and I'm like, what if it was reversed? You know, like it's the Uncle Tom white guy or black guy kind of thing where he comes in and then the white guy is like, I hate black people and all this stuff. I mean, that show would not go over well if that's
right.
what it was, you know? And I'm watching, and as the show's going on and everything, I mean, the kids on the show are adorable.
Uh-huh.
I think the daughter doing the, you know, all this stuff.
The thesis project of her family.
Yeah, no, I think all of that stuff is, you know, like I said, I think it's adorable and everything. It's great. But just the way, you know, and then, of course, I get it. You know, it's a caricature of the woman, the overly white liberal woman who's into Greenpeace, who's the attorney and everything. And she's talking about going camping in a yurt and, you know. All this nonsense, right? It's a caricature. I get it. But what I'm saying is, though, like, reverse the caricatures and reverse everything. And, man, that show would not happen. And if it did, talk about being canceled. You know? And it bothered me, though. Like, and maybe I wouldn't have thought about it so much if it wasn't for this week. And it bothered me. Because I think when you think about getting over these racial problems, it's a two-way street, you know? Like, you can't say white people don't or shouldn't behave this way, but yet black people, like, and I would say, I mean, I fully acknowledge there's white privilege. Mm-hmm. But I think in some regard, there's black privilege to... Because, like, white people don't have the privilege to say, I hate black people. Hmm. But why do black people have the privilege to say, I hate white people, and it's okay? And that, like, and what I'm getting at is, though, that kind of bothered me in the overtone of this whole thing of, I don't think it's good for anybody to say anything about hating anybody.
Because of the color of their skin.
Because of the color of their skin, right.
So you can't say that regardless of the color of their skin. I get it. I get your point. I think that I would say it is a...
It's not easy. Let's put it that way, right?
Yeah, it's definitely not easy. But I think there's a freshness to what sometimes is called reverse racism. But because of slavery, as the title of every show, you know, represents, there is, I would say, at least 380, maybe 370 years of oppression that kind of can never be equated. Like, you know, beyond reparations, let's just talk about social acceptable things. The reason that there's a thing called white privilege is because it's there. And I know you were trying to say black privilege, but it's really not black privilege. In that show, it's more about monetary privilege. You know, it's about green privilege. You know, it's like the wealth.
Well, yeah, because he's so wealthy, I guess.
The wealth is the equalizer. And I think what it shows is that wealth allows you to feel the privilege. And when you go back to your statements about generational wealth, and we agree that there has been an oppression of a people for 400 years, or, you know, shy 20 maybe, you know, even we've had an African American president, and yet we are still here. We still have not come farther than civil rights. You know, it's like civil rights happened. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. died.
Well, 50 years ago.
But, you know, the big thing that my daughter keeps saying is, like, you know, they had pictures in color of civil rights movements of Martin Luther King, but they kept them all black and white in all of our textbooks and school books so that we would feel more disconnected from it. So it'd feel like it was a longer time in the past. And I'm like, the institutional racism is also educational racism. You know what I mean? Like, when I was growing up.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
When I was growing up, I was told the Civil War was fought about states' rights, and that the slavery angle was just this very small, you know, single digit percentage of the South cared about their slavery. Right. And, you know, and I it's know. Like, that's what I was taught 30 years ago, 35 years ago, whatever. So, you know, I think that is, to me, that's the refreshing part of it. It kind of hits you the way Archie Bunker hit back in the day, where it was like unaccepted in the public, but there was something going on there. And the way that Lear was doing it, he was doing it through the hard conversations within the family. family. You know what I mean? So they have other hard conversations in this family. And I like this because it's a little more nuanced. You know what I mean? Him and his wife, their dynamic, I don't know. You only watch one episode, two episodes?
One episode, yeah.
One episode. So their dynamic is kind of the whole thing of the show. And it's an interesting dynamic. And Kenya Barris has to defend like the way he wrote his wife, the way he wrote that character that plays, you know, his on-screen wife. So I don't know. I agree that it's not acceptable to say that, but I think there is... It was refreshing to me that he can say something like that, and it's almost not. There's almost very. There's a little less threat to it. That's the crux of what's going on there. Like when he says, "I hate white people" or "the white gaze," you know what I mean? Like I thought that was an interesting turn of phrase. I just think that there's when white racists say they hate black people, it ends in a lynching or a flag burning, I mean, or a cross burning or some, you know, some other horrific act of violence. And yet when a modern, wealthy, affluent black man says, "I hate white people," there's a comedy of reversal to it that is not, it's a hyperbolic statement. It's not like, "I'm going to kill you." You know, I mean, there's nothing threatening about Kenya Barris in his tracksuit, in his, you know, athleisure saying, "I hate white people." So to me, it's the lack of threat that is the humor when supposedly the police feel so threatened by the mere presence of black men, you know?
Well, and I think you said it with Archie Bunker, and I was leaning towards that, but I didn't really like place it in that until you said it, and I think I agree in that the way Norman Lear identified, well, maybe not identified, the way Norman Lear created Archie Bunker, he wanted to make such a white buffoon that people would look at him and say, "Wow, is this guy a moron? How could he possibly believe that?"
Right.
But it backfired.
People loved it.
Too many people right. identified with him. And I think that's kind of what I'm getting at is either A, people will identify, or people will be the antithesis of identifying, essentially, and feel attacked or something, and maybe will drive people further to the right. And I'm not saying that I didn't find the show, you know, humorous or funny or anything.
Right.
What I'm saying is my mom watches this. That show entrenches her further into Trump.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You know, and that's what I'm getting at. Like, I mean, I get the nuance that you're talking right. about. I understand that. And I understand the nuance of Archie Bunker.
Right.
But I don't think people who watch these things sometimes understand the nuance, and I think it either supports their prejudice or it entrenches them, you know, more into the radical right conservative side, or you know what I mean? Like
the biases are enforced, yeah, reinforced.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And what I'm saying is, it's not that the show in and of itself is a bad show or anything like that. What I'm saying is, at some point, we need to come together and, like, whatever angle you're coming at, whether it's a comedy on Netflix, it's the news media, I mean, whatever, it's the police or, you know, it's people in the neighborhood or whatever, we have to stop, you know, even comedians, and they make these jokes and so on and everything. Like, at some point we have to stop with all this racial innuendo, because I think it just entrenches people further into their camps, you know? Yeah. And I mean, I don't know how to get people out of their camps. Like, I talk to my mom and it's just like, "Oh my God," like, "I gotta put earplugs in or something," you know? And I mean, people just have the ideas they have over this stuff. And that's why I say, like, I think a lot of, you know, the Molotov cocktail throwers and stuff, I mean, are doing so to hijack a moment mm-hmm. and steal it from what the message is supposed to be about.
Right.
Man, it's just, I don't know. I just think at some point, white, black, and, you know, like, whatever. I mean, Mexican, you know, like, who's the one Mexican, the chubby Mexican comedian, you know, and stuff? And
oh, what's his name? Fluffy. Yeah.
I forget. No, I'm just saying, like, all these people that have these, like, kind of racial jokesters and stuff, yeah, they're funny. I get it. Eddie Murphy on SNL back in, what is it, the 80s when he put on the white makeup, right. You know, and stuff. It's funny. But I think, like, at some point we have to stop doing that because it just entrenches people in their camps.
Right.
You know, and that's the point of what I'm getting at with the show, the Black AF show, is that white people might watch it and say, like, F that guy.
Right.
And black people watch it and say, right on, white people suck. And, like, you're not doing, you're not helping to solve a problem rather
than fanning the flames.
It's divisive, mm-hmm. You know, and that's the point I'm getting at, you know, I mean, but whatever. What do I know?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you said the, you know, if we compare, what's his name? Archie Bunker? Is that, that wasn't the name of the show. Archie Bunker?
Archie Bunker. No, All in the Family.
So if you compare All in the Family to Black AF, you know, it's so different because when All in the Family was on, everybody in America was watching it, right? Like, you didn't have a choice. It was like that and two other things. You had three things.
No, you had three networks. You had the local affiliate, and you had PBS.
So maybe at you had tops, five you had channels. Five things going on at that one time.
Exactly.
But it was popular, so it was taking up a lot of the bandwidth of people, and it was in the zeitgeist. You know, a show like Black AF, somebody turns it on, like, are you going to, what Trump supporter would even want to watch that show?
Well, that's a good point.
You know what I mean? So I think Norman Lee was ahead of his time.
Oh, I couldn't agree more with that. Yeah, for sure.
And like, he was so brilliant in what he was trying to do that he missed his crowd. But I think now, I think the audiences are a little more savvy, and other than using sound bites and trying to utilize clips of something to fan the flames of the injustice and the reverse injustice, I think it's such a human, you know, if you get through the whole thing, you don't have to, obviously, but when I got through the whole thing, and this was of course pre George Floyd, so I definitely had a different take on it, but when I got through it, it was so touching that they had familial issues, you know what I mean, that were so fresh in my mind with the 14-year-old and, you know, and a wife, and we're in quarantine, you know, and we're all like in close quarters, so even though they're rich, it's nice to see that they had familial issues, you know? So that's what drew me to it. And I guess I laughed off the other stuff because, you know, because of slavery.
All right. So we're like way deep into this hour all of a sudden. So let's talk about Joe Coy. I think that Joe Coy in his elements.
It's tangential to what we're talking about a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah. It's loosely into all this because, I mean, you know, he's Filipino. It is a racial sort of a thing, I guess. Maybe not in the sense of.
It's a cultural piece.
Cultural. There you go. That's a better way to put it.
So
yeah.
Joe Coy has another Netflix special.
Joe Coy. Is he one of your cousins?
He could be.
You know, he's got the same hairdo but no beard.
Right, exactly. Yeah, he shaves it all off.
So in his elements, would you say his elements are more like family, food, entertainment, like all of the culture of, like, because it's more plural, would you say that's all of the culture of the Philippines, or what do you think he means by in his elements?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it is that, you know, it's interesting because we saw Joe Coy at a Filipino festival like so many years ago. I forget, Bryce was like 4 years old. And we went to the Hollywood Bowl and they had like a Filipino Heritage Month concert, and Joe Coy did a set there, and it was amazing. He's great, but he does the thing that we were just talking about where, you know, it's his own culture, so he can appropriate it, you know what I mean? So he pokes fun at Filipinos because he is a Filipino, and I think it is especially Filipino to self-deprecate, you know? So they make fun of themselves a lot, or we make fun of ourselves. The half of we make fun of ourselves a lot.
Half of we.
So when he does that, you're kind of on edge a little bit, typically, because you don't know if he's like profiteering off of making fun of his own people and his own race. And, you know, it's kind of a strange laugh that you kind of have to let go of. And to me, this is the payoff. You know, it's like he got popular and enough clout to get a suite of Netflix specials, and for one of his specials to kind of dedicate it back to his country, his people, bring it to Manila, you know, and then make it into what looks like a variety show is kind of interesting. It's an interesting way to give people a platform that typically wouldn't necessarily have a global or Western platform, and then, you know, share that wealth with his brethren.
What I like about it, though, is the trailer looks like the show. It looks like a series. I didn't look in. Is it a series?
Oh, I didn't even look. I thought, is this a special?
Oh, it might just be a special. But what I like about it, though, is he gets into the food. He gets into the neighborhoods. He gets into all those things that make him Filipino, which what I enjoy of it is it's almost like, I don't know, I'm going to go visit the Philippines. Let me watch this show. He's going to give me a taste of the Philippines before I get there, so I know what to expect when I arrive. And there's I wouldn't say a large Filipino population in Lompoc, but there's a large enough Filipino where there's always the food truck when you go to the different events.
Yeah.
And there's some restaurants, and there's some friends that we have in town, a teacher I worked with and so on. And, you know, and she always brings a lupini and everything. And, you know, we go to the birthday parties and she has like the Filipino food laid out and stuff. I mean, it's phenomenal. I mean, she's like a great cook, you know? And, you know, with that, I feel, you know, a little bit connected.
Uh-huh.
And then obviously knowing you.
But I don't really wear my Filipino-ness on my sleeve. You know what I mean? Like,
no, I would agree with that. Like, if I didn't know you were half Filipino, I wouldn't know you were half Filipino, because I don't know. I don't want to say you're not proud of it, but what I'm going to say is, like, you're not overboard with it. You know, like, I think some people, like, I have some Italian family. I mean, they beat you over the head how Italian they are.
Right, right, right.
And I'm like, dude, you grew up in the suburbs, you know, like, you're not Italian. You know what I mean? Or whatever. But yeah, there's some people that they just beat you up with their nationality or their ethnicity. And then there's other people, like, they just let it ride. Yeah. And, you know, they're more assimilated, I guess, or whatever. But
let's just say the last time I watched this, and I, you know, they show the streets and the sights and all the food markets and all that stuff.
Oh, I love it.
And I thought, okay, when was the last time I was there? Okay, it was like 32 years ago, 33 years ago.
Well, I was going to ask, have you visited?
I've been there a couple of times. I went when my grandfather was dying 33 years ago. And when I went there, I went, my mother couldn't get free at the time, so I went with my aunt. And my aunt just went, literally just to pay her last respects, you know?
What do you mean your mom couldn't get free?
She was working or something, and she couldn't come. She was going to go later.
Oh, she wasn't incarcerated.
No. She was going to come later, like later in the week.
Oh, okay.
So she made me go with my aunt, and my aunt came, you know, I went with my aunt and we all went over there.
From the States.
From Washington, D.C. So from Washington, D.C. to the Philippines to Manila is like a over 24-hour plane trip because of the layovers and all that stuff.
Ugh.
So it takes over 24 hours to get there. We landed there. We went and saw my grandfather in the hospital.
And you were like 11 or something.
I was like 12 or something like that. I paid my last respects. Then she was getting on the plane the very next day to go home because she had work to go back to too. And I was supposed to stay there and wait for my mother to come later in the week.
Wait, she flew 24 hours and then left the next day?
So we stayed short. The time we were on the ground in Manila was shorter than both legs of our trip. So we spent 30 hours to get there and like 32 hours to go back. And we were on the ground for 24 hours. And when I came back to D.C., my mom was so shocked. She goes, "You were supposed to stay there and wait for me." I'm like, "Nope. I'm not waiting in a foreign country for you. I am here in Washington, D.C., and this is where I'm from. And
was that your first time out of the country?
Oh no, I was, you know, with my dad was a cartographer, so we traveled a lot. I was around.
Oh wow,
we went around the world before I was three.
Okay, that don't count though.
I know.
You got to have memory of it.
Well, my first memories are like in Kathmandu and Nepal. And
what? Who is this guy?
In Kuala Lumpur for 6 months.
Okay, wait. We're episode 121, and I'm finally like learning about Kathmandu.
Yeah, we stayed at the Yak and Yeti Hotel for like 2.5 weeks, and I befriended all the merchants in the first floor. In the first floor of the Yak and Yeti Hotel, there's a bunch of like shops, and I got to sell jewelry in the jewelry shop to all the American tourists. You know, as a 10-year-old American in this, you know, they thought the Australians and the Americans thought it was funny that this little kid was trying to sell them jewelry. You know.
Oh man, you got to tell me more over more beers. We have more time.
There was a travel agency there, and they took me on a flight over Everest. So that was a lot of fun.
Wow. Wow.
But yeah, so as far as like travel, you know, something Ann and I love to do, but we don't do enough because it's so expensive.
Well, tell me about it.
This Joe Coy special made me, I think it was the first time I was interested about going back there. You know, there was something that was interesting about going back. Not that I ever lived there, but you know, going there, I guess just going there. Not saying going back there.
Visit, right. I get it. To visit and everything. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, I think what it is, it's like when you have a heritage, like growing up, Italian heritage and my grandmother, you know, and cooking and language and all this stuff, you know, and hearing stories and things. It's like, I've never been to Italy. I've been to a number of places out of the country, but I've never been to Italy. And yeah, I totally want to go to Italy. And I would love to look up distant family in Naples and so on. But that's so long ago. I mean, they're probably so distant from me now. But just to go and understand kind of like where my family came from, even though I'm sure today it's a completely different world.
Right.
You know, it's not the world of 1910 or whatever the heck it was.
It's not,
know?
Godfather 2.
Two. Right. You know, I mean, but I get it, though. And the thing that I like about the trailer is that it shows, and that's why I asked the question about what's with the title when it's elements, when you have, you know, it gives the impression of more than one. And it's like it's the food, like it's the entire culture, right? It's the food, it's the family, it's the language, and maybe the music and whatever involves a culture.
And the variety show of the people that he's invited on his stage.
Well, there you go too, right. All right, man. You know, hey, this was a crazy week, and I think we had a heartfelt discussion.
Yes.
So, you know, but I think the Joe Coy thing was apropos in regard to we're looking at culture and color and race and ethnicity and all the things that come with that.
Right.
And you know, and hey, I mean, I think it's everybody has their thing, you know, and I love travel, and maybe we can all go to the Philippines one
day.
I would love that. You can show me around.
Here's some place I don't remember ever being. Let's do that.
Right. I was here for a day when I was 10. Grandpa's bedroom. No, I wouldn't expect you to be there. But I mean, we could always have more conversations about Kathmandu and going to Nepal and stuff, man. Wow, I had no idea. But no, you know, I mean, ultimately, though, I think, you know, there's something about this whole experience that this collective experience that we're all neck deep in right now and everything. And I don't know, man, I just think at some point we got to get past this guy hating that guy and that guy hating this guy. And I don't care who either guy is.
Right.
We just have to get past it and just be like, dude, how are we going to make our world a better place for everybody? I mean, and I know I talk about bike advocacy and stuff, but I mean, a lot of the thing that comes up and what I always always say. And there's this, they call themselves, I hate to even give them publicity, but they call themselves Cars Are Basic. And I first learned about them when they put a public comment in for this week with the bike infrastructure thing. So I look them up and it's just a bunch of old white guys bitching and moaning about any infrastructure, whether buses, bikes, anything other than cars, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to hear them talk, it's like they're, I mean, these guys are just, they're just old white guys who hate equity. And I think when I talk about all this stuff, one of the major things I'm looking at is equity, right? Not everybody owns a car, and we want people under 16 to be able to get around. We want people who are too old to own a car to get around. We want people who can't afford a car to get around, or people who choose not to afford a car to get around.
Right.
That has nothing to do with race necessarily. I mean, there's a lot of racial undertones within that, I understand. But what I'm getting at is, like, if you look at equity, equity is more than racial, but equity is a lot of things, to include age and gender and religions and everything. And at some point, people just need modes of transportation.
Yeah, the cost of mobility is not a car. It doesn't have to be a car.
And equity sometimes is, I should be able to go somewhere freely without being stereotyped as and questioned as, why am I here?
Right.
A black man should be able to just either A, ride his bike and feel safe to do so, drive a car, or me as a white guy should be able to go into a neighborhood, get lost, and be able to leave that neighborhood without the police pulling me over,
right,
to say, why are you here? Oh, it's because it's a black neighborhood and only drugs and prostitutes take place here.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's all this racial stuff that goes on that I don't know how you get a past it. I don't know how. But at some point, we need to, and television shows like, you know, I mean, we brought up like the 70s from Archie Bunker or Black AF, whatever. And there's a lot of other ones too. But I mean, at some point, we need to get past it. And I don't know how we do that. I'd say at that, we call it, man. Yes. What do you say?
We can't break the institutions in 1 hour. So
No, but I think it was, you know, I mean, I don't know. I'm really impassioned by these things, and I work in education, and the kids I work with all too often come from like poverty, and, you know, and I just see these heartbreaking stories, you know, like, and in the end, man, they're just kids. How do you get them out of it? And how do you get them from turning into like radicals, you know, like,
yeah, or falling into the stereotypes, or falling through the cracks. And yeah,
I just want these kids to like grow up and be productive and
be happy.
Be happy and find that thing that they could self-actualize with and get into it and like be the person they were meant to be and like just not be so angry at everything, you know, and like angry at like everybody that doesn't look like them and even people that look like them, you know, like I get tired of being angry at like my mom over.
Yeah,
serious.
Yeah,
like it's totally. Anyway, I think we covered it. I don't think we covered it well, but we covered it
as well as we can, and with
empathy
and with as much understanding as I think we can. So we tried.
right. Whatever. It is what it is.
Thank you.
All right, man. But yeah, we'll catch up next week. We can pick up all this other like silly nonsense and we can joke and be more lighthearted next week. But yeah, this week I think we needed to just say what we needed to get off our hearts because it's too much.
All right. Have a good night.
All right, Ted. Yeah, you too, man. We'll talk to you.
Bye.